Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
We're back! It's a distraction. I'm Drew, that's Roth. How you doing, Roth?
Oh, I'm really good, Drew. How are you, man?
You don't, that didn't sound very sincere, I'll be honest.
I know. Do you want me to, let me try it again. I'm doing okay, man. How are you? Sorry, I aimed too high, and I think it did come off a little phony.
This is real fucking beat, but I did a tweet, and I just want to reiterate the point that, like, if someone says to me, "How are you?" like, I automatically say fine. Like, sometimes I automatically go right to fine, even if they haven't said it. They'll just be like, "Hello," and I'll be like, "I'm fine." And then, but like, if someone comes to me and they go, "Drew, how the hell are you?" Then I'm like, oh, I feel fucking great. Now you just said that, like, it's like, make it sound like you haven't seen me in like 20 years and like you just went through a desert and I'm the only person you wanted to see that whole time you were there. And now you see me and you're so happy. Now I'm happy.
I mean,
so how the hell are you now, Roth?
I get that every Wednesday and it does elevate my mood a little bit. The serotonin shortages are, I would say, critical here. And if it wasn't for you greeting me enthusiastically once a week on a Zoom call, I don't know where I'd be.
Well, that was true during the pandemic. I was like, oh, I get to actually, like, see another human being.
Yeah. Even, like, in your little computer, like, the idea of, like, I can't wait for Drew to yell at me about the Vikings for precisely 52 minutes.
Yeah, and great. I don't even have the box maximized because I have to look at the rundown document. So you're literally 2 inches wide on my screen. So I'm like, oh. But there he is. And you know who else is here? It's Liz Cook, Kansas City food writer. Liz Cook, the legendary Liz Cook of Haterade, and a freelance food critic for The Pitch. She joins us. How are you doing, Liz?
I am doing swell, which is my default response, like a vaudevillian carnival barker.
You know, it's swell. Swell is a better word. I asked my editor, Barry Pacheski, if I could rant against the word fine because I hate it so much. And he's like, yeah, but why? What's the difference between that and like, okay, or all right? And I was like, I don't know, but I just fucking hate it. And he's like, no, that's not really good enough, Drew. So
swell is good, though, because it's like it both gets the message across and also, like, I don't know that it's going to get followed up necessarily. Like, people aren't going to be like, oh, like, they're not going to, like, talk to you in the Music Man voice after that. They're just going to be like, this lady's doing okay.
that's the idea, right? It just gets you from having to go into any kind of detail at all.
Yeah, but it's like it's a bit friendlier. It could have a tinge of irony to it, depending on how you phrase. Like, I'm swell, doing swell. Everything's fucking great. Or you can be like, yeah, I'm doing swell. I'm all right.
So is it established now that all of us are doing okay? That we're at least a baseline level of okay?
Yeah, which is really all you want out of a podcast. You know,
it's all right. Well, thank you everybody for joining us. Our producer is Brandon Nix.
I tune into every podcast, and I'm like, man, I hope the people doing this podcast are all right and agree with each other about everything. And then I hope they recap The Sopranos.
I hope this podcast episode will just be titled, Drew and David Are Doing Fine.
That's right.
And you. Yeah. And Liz is also well. That will be the headline on the post when I put it on the website.
So I want to talk to you, Liz. We want to talk to you about your career as a food critic. But first, we have to fulfill our contract to do some obligatory sports content because we learned, Liz, yesterday that you are a fan of Arsenal.
You are.
In the Premier League.
Are you having a laugh, mate?
So I wanted to ask you about Arsenal because I follow other people who are also fans of Arsenal, and they seem perpetually exasperated and pissed off at Arsenal all the time. And I wanted to ask why that is. Like, what is so shitty about Arsenal that they make you want to die?
Yeah, well, you may not know this about Arsenal, but it's actually Latin for to struggle with God. This is sort of baked into our, our fan base.
Is that true? You're not, like, joking? That's actually
true? No, I'm 100% joking.
Oh, my God. Oh, all right. I was like, wow, you learned something new.
I was going through the roots and like thinking I needed to dust up on my Greek or whatever. But yeah, that. So what is it, though? I always think of them as being one of the good teams. I don't follow it very closely, but like, are they uniquely, like, are you secretly like a Mets fan just for soccer? Is that
no,
what you're saying?
Well, so like, it's kind of the classic like little brother energy. And I relate to this very much as someone from the Midwest, because I think like people from the Midwest have this chip on their shoulder too. Like, Arsenal is fine. They're a great team. They play beautiful football, but they were, I guess, during the Wenger years, like perpetually fourth. They were never kind of at the top of the table. And so there's always this perception that like, even though you're a team with a ton of money, you're like still in the top half of the Premier League, you're winning the FA Cup, that you're somehow the underdog. And so there's like this aggrieved characteristic that feels baked into the fan base.
I like the idea that you could just gravitate to that even from many, many miles away. That like, I often feel like that when I went to school in Southern California, I was a New Jersey Nets fan as a kid, which was not fun. I mean, they were bad. And I went there and I had a choice. Like, I was on a whole other side of the country. I couldn't watch the Nets if I wanted to because the technology didn't exist. And so I could have chosen like the Kobe Shaq Lakers or the pre-Lamar Odom Los Angeles Clippers. And it was like, ooh, I didn't even have a say in it. I just became a Clippers fan while I was there and watched like Maurice Taylor eat a large sandwich during games and stuff like that. That was just like the lot that I backed into because it was like an autonomic response to that.
Yeah, I really
are they
that.
Are they an annoying team presently? Like, are there players on their end who are essential to the team but who you actively dislike and are annoyed by?
Oh, so probably the big one for me is Granit Xhaka. He is kind of our biggest liability, and like one out of every five games, he'll be absolutely brilliant. And then the other four, he'll just do incredibly lazy tackles, get benched, open up penalties. So he's kind of the one that we still keep playing. And that's probably the biggest frustration I have with Mikel Arteta right now, is that he's relying on Granit Xhaka a lot, who I see as this like big liability. But the rest of the players, like, we had a great transfer window. We had some good signings. And I feel like for once, kind of optimistic.
Where are they on the table? They are not in the Champions League this time around. Is that
correct? No, they are not. So we missed out on that. And we are not very high up in the table either, which makes our,
Ooh, you're 10th.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's not good.
Yeah, which makes our win against Tottenham feel all the sweeter, I will say.
Because they're 11th. So you got that going.
Yes, we got that going for us, which is nice. But we're below Brentford. It doesn't feel
great. Yeah, I was going to ask,
great.
Can you just give me some made up names? Is there like, where are they relative to Twirlingham?
Twirlingham.
Brentford is one of those. Over the past few years, I've acquired a pretty decent knowledge of which teams are actually in the Premier League. Because like a decade ago, I would have been like, Crystal Palace. The fuck is that? Like, do they play in a literal Crystal Palace? They don't, and they should. But I was always like Aston Villa. That's not a real name for a team. But now, like, I know them all. But Brentford, which I assume has to have been promoted recently.
Yeah, I think it was this year, right?
That's got real real silly British town name energy to it, even though it's pretty
good. It should be like Brentford upon the sea or something. That would make it
perfect. Anything upon anything, I enjoy quite a bit. What about Arsenal fans? Are they annoying? I know Chelsea fans are racist, and really all European soccer fans are racist. But like, what is there a distinctive insufferability to Arsenal fans that no other team can replicate?
I think Arsenal kind of take the cake for being like whiny bitches. Like, there's just kind of this fatalistic quality that the Arsenal fans have that I find like really frustrating. The Wenger out chants, the Arteta outs chanted, like chants started almost as soon as he kind of took over. I think it's just like the slightest inkling that things aren't going exactly the way we want. And it's just like a wholesale chaos energy. So that's something that I find super annoying.
Well, as a Vikings fan, I'm utterly, utterly unfamiliar with feeling that way at all. But my team never, ever feel that way. Hey, let's talk about food, because you are a freelance food critic. And I wanted to talk about something that was in your newsletter, Haterade. I believe it was last week. You referenced Salejo's column in the San Francisco Chronicle earlier this month about how she couldn't wait to get back to negative restaurant reviews because they went sort of on hold during the pandemic, right? Because the restaurant industry famously struggled during the pandemic and is struggling now because of a sea change over to, it's sort of the pandemic gave a lot of corporations tacit permission to just abandon the restaurant model altogether and start operating out of ghost kitchens and not bother with anything anymore. Meanwhile, Pete Wells of the New York Times wrote a fantastic pan of 11 Madison Park this week, but noted that he still does not give star ratings out, and I assume he would have given it no stars, which would have been funny, because the pandemic is still essentially ongoing. So the questions for you are, was it right for restaurant critics to sort of engage in this, I want to say compassionate act during the pandemic? Was it all for show? And will we get back to objective restaurant criticism anytime soon? And did it ever exist? So I have, there's four questions for
okay,
you.
Okay, yeah.
Please answer them in order.
Yeah.
So I'll take the first one, I guess, which was, right, was it right for them to stop writing negative reviews? That's the first one.
Yes.
I think you'd have to, because the restaurant industry just didn't exist the way that it had for years, for the first part of the pandemic. So I think, like, necessarily, if places are shut down, if they're suddenly switching to takeout models, if they're operating with half staff, like, it's kind of ludicrous to, like, you know, take the piss out of someone who's operating in that way because they don't like it any more than you do. Like, this is not them trying to, you know, do their best. They don't feel that that's their best offering. I guess whether how long that grace period should be extended, I think, is super regional specific. So, like, you know, Soleil's column was really interesting to me because in San Francisco, they've had like way harsher pandemic restrictions that have lasted for a lot longer than in Kansas City, where, you know, like 6 months after, you know, the pandemic started, we were back at full capacity. We could dine indoors, you know, everything was off to the races. So, like,
it was totally safe.
Yeah, totally safe. But restaurants were going back to normal. They were operating with like full dining rooms. And so, like, that context is super different. So if you're operating in that context, I think it makes much more sense to like come, like, if restaurants are going to treat it like everything's normal, then probably journalists covering them, I mean, they should point out the ludicrous nature of that, but they should, you know, cover them with that same kind of critical eye.
I was interested because you wrote a really, really well-written review of Society, a new restaurant in Kansas City. And it was a negative review. I mean, essentially. And I thought it was fair, but it was interesting because Society, and correct me if I'm wrong, was essentially part of a restaurant collective. And so it's hard, and I don't think readers quite know, I'm not sure they're availed of this when they read any given restaurant review. It's not like a guarantee, but it's hard to tell whether or not when you give a restaurant review, if you're punching up at a gigantic consortium or you're punching down at a mom and pop operation. Because, you know, a lot of people, their first assumption is it's a small business. That's the only restaurant and it's their entire livelihood. And you, the food critic, if you're mean to it, you're going to fuck their lives.
Yeah, no, that's 100% fair. Like, it's probably not dissimilar from the sports world, right? Like, the punching up versus punching down question. Like, you go after the places with a ton of money because they can soak it up. Like, they're already soaking up all of the attention and all of the PR cash and all of the kind of like buzzy influencer energy. So it makes much more sense to kind of take the wind out of their particular sails. I'm probably not going to write the same kind of review of, like, you know, one woman who put her life savings into opening a lunch counter and she's, you know, doing the dishes and, you know, doing the accounting herself.
You call these hand-pulled noodles?
Right.
You piece of shit.
Yeah. That seems to be the thing with the Wells negative reviews that wind up viral, or, like, you know, or not even viral. I mean, I think the ones that, like, make a big impression, because I don't think that, like, this isn't the same thing as the Guy Fieri review or whatever, like, writing about how 11 Madison Park is, like, a little up its own ass. It's kind of like, that's going to appeal to people like me that read every review of that restaurant, even though I cannot afford to go there. But, like, it's not, I don't know that it's going to break out of that circle of weirdos. But it seems like Wells is most comfortable going after places that are not just in terms of, like, punching up, punching down versus who owns it, but that are, like, promising a remarkable experience at an astronomical price point and then not delivering it. And I think that that has, there's nothing retributive about it to me. It's so much as it is just sort of like a way of checking this trend. And I guess that that's, like, part of restaurant reviewing that I sort of have never really understood because I haven't been in the scene enough. Like, you have written well about, like, the role that sort of critics play relative to people that report on the industry itself. And you've talked about in the newsletter like how those two things are kind of in conflict. That like if you are a critic of a restaurant and you're reviewing it as such, that's very different than like having to call them on the phone and get them on the record about like this or that trend in the industry. And I guess like this is a broad question, but like how healthy do you feel like the world of writing about restaurants and food is right now? Like, do you feel as if it's so small and everybody is so overtaxed that there's a sense in which it's conflicted, like almost out of comprehensibility?
I don't know if I would say that. I think like there's a ton of food writing and there's a ton of food media out there. Mm-hmm. So I think like in that sense, the scene seems super healthy, but I think like full-time positions where you can actually like take risks in the sense of like a Pete Wellesian type position are almost like there's maybe like 5 full-time food critics that
yeah,
I can
like
think of.
If that.
Yeah.
That's not even hyperbole. Like right. that might be an overestimate.
Right. And so you're left with kind of like freelancers who are always going to be kind of making the same trade-offs that I am. Like, you know, it's really tempting to like, you know, go to all of these like free openings or media tastings when you make no money and like can't afford to try out a bunch of spots and you can't afford to like take a big swing and miss. So I think that's super unhealthy. And I think the other, this is like not super related, but the other unhealthy thing I think about the food media landscape right now is that like, it's so up its own ass. I think food writers are some of the most like intensely self-absorbed people I see in like a room of journalists, which feels like a high bar to clear.
Yeah, but seriously, it's like...
Yeah, but really? There's like so much meta commentary, and obviously like I'm engaging in the same thing in the newsletter, so like who the fuck am I to judge? But like I think there's this level of discourse among food writers where it feels like anymore they're just talking to each other instead of talking to consumers or like people that are actually going out and eating at these places. So like that's another thing that I think is a huge problem. Like the more kind of fraught this industry becomes, the more like food writers sort of band together as this like weird, you know, clique that seems like they're so far removed from talking about anything that matters to anyone else.
Could you be a bit more specific about that?
Yeah, can you name some names? Who are the biggest assholes?
I was gonna ask her
to
name names, but it doesn't even have to be. It doesn't have to be naming names. It could be like just sort of examples of specific types of discourse that has, you know, that gets into the digestive tract and doesn't get out.
Yeah, so I think like there's whole newsletters like Family Meal is one of them that's just like all about kind of aggregating and like making fun of things that food writers are saying, which is it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to read.
But then
I think like you also get into this with kind of like the cultural appropriation discourse where like some of it's really necessary and important. And then sometimes it's just like, you know, a food writer getting really mad at someone in the New York Times presenting a dish in the wrong cultural context and like that taking on a huge other life. And then I'm just thinking like, a lot of people, you know, in Kansas City have no idea what this dish is, like, let alone, you know, like, I've never heard of this, and now I'm supposed to get mad about it. It just feels kind of like, I don't know, that's probably, I probably sound like an old crank now, like the kids these days and their cultural.
No, you're with two middle-aged men, so, you know.
But I think there is something about that idea of, like, a meta-argument happening above, and, like, maybe not even like legible to the people. Like my mother gets all of her recipes from the New York Times, pretty much new ones. But I don't think that she's aware of the idea that like using sumac is considered problematic. She's like, we found this delightful spice and you can get it at the store. And like, that's just basically how she engages this stuff. And I think that, I mean, I guess it makes sense that my mom wouldn't be a part of the, you know, like, as just a septuagenarian who's looking for sassy new salad recipes, like, she wouldn't be engaging with the sort of cultural, you know, meta element of it. But I don't know. I guess it's sort of disappointing, I guess, to hear that, like, that part of it is such a big part of the discourse. Because I guess, like, I like reading about restaurants and I like reading recipes and stuff like that because I like eating a lot. And I feel like there, you know, there should be joy in that, like, that should be centered in it, just because that seems like the kind of the point of the whole thing. Not to completely, you know, ignore the politics of it, but that's why people go to restaurants in the first place, is that it's like, it's more fun than cooking and you get to eat stuff you don't know how to make.
Like, yeah, and I think like that's actually a better entry point for a lot of like the broader cultural critiques and political arguments you want to make. Like, you can bring people in with that kind of universality and commonality and kind of joy. And then, you know, stretch them a little bit further. But sometimes it feels like we're like just shouting at a public that, you know, is so far removed from the discourse that we're having that like we need to have like long catch up conversations to get them to the point where they'll understand what we're upset about.
Yeah. The other thing is that a lot of this, a lot of this discourse, I'm abusing that word and I'm sorry about that, but it runs parallel to, and I think we talked to Pete Wells about this when we had him on, it runs parallel to, but never intersects with, or rarely intersects with, the problems of the restaurant business itself, which have been well documented and yet continually need to be documented over and over again. Because I've worked in restaurant kitchens with like abusive chefs and stuff like that. And I know of people who have also done it. And yet the presentation of food criticism can sometimes elide that and the perception of what the restaurant is that the people are reviewing. Like, for example, this goes out of the realm of abuse, but like Wells's review of Peter Luger, like he took a shit on it because they treat their customers like shit, right? And so to that end, it doesn't really matter what size that business is. If they're doing their job wrong or poorly, it behooves the person covering them to say they're doing a shit job of it, right?
Yeah, well, I think, and that's what gets you back to like, okay, why are the biggest swings at like the Peter Lugers, at the 11 Madison Park? And it's in part because like, this is an experience that's so exclusive, that's so difficult to access for so many people. And right. If you're doing what you think is consumer-oriented criticism, you have to think like, okay, you know, maybe it's mostly like Wall Street assholes who are going to this place, but there's probably also a couple who like went to New York and saved up. And this is like their dream to eat at 11 Madison Park, this famous restaurant. Mm-hmm. And it's maybe the only like splurge they're going to make all year. So like, is this a sensible thing? Like, and it's what you said, Drew, if you're treating your customers like shit, yeah, you got to point that out. And that's like a different equation than like the mom and pop spot. If you're only out $12, it's a little bit different.
Yeah. I think that's true. The other thing I wanted to ask you was for Haterade, you bought Honda mouse tape that prevents mice from chewing through wires, and you licked it to make sure. And you wrapped it around a cocktail glass as well. And you said it didn't taste good. You wouldn't recommend tasting it. But since you wrote that post, have you gotten a hankering to taste mouse tape again?
Like, have I become part mouse? Like, is this transformation happening?
Well, they
no,
hate
no.
It.
Did you like you ever eat something and you're like, oh, I don't like it, but then like a day later you're like kind of curious, you're like, kind of, it was interesting, didn't bore me. Look, would mouse tape fall into that category?
Yeah, I'm still sold on the potential of mouse tape. I will say like the actual experience of the mouse tape was a letdown, not because it tasted bad, just because it didn't taste like that much. Like I wanted a Bloody Mary rim that had a little bit extra piquancy. And I'm a little bit skeptical that this heat on this tape is actually deterring any rodents. So we'll see.
To get everybody up to speed, like basically this is you had mice living in your engine, as one does. That was a problem that we had in Maine this summer. It's a fucking bummer. There's just no way to resolve it that isn't depressing and gross. But the tape itself that you're supposed to put in there that makes the mice not gnaw on your shit is like, it's just basically hot sauce, right? Like you said, it's just like capsaicin is the active ingredient in it.
Yeah, it's just pure capsaicin extract that's coated on this tape. But it's a pretty mild dose, I would say.
I would think that it might be nice to do it in other flavors. I don't know that the mice would like it, but I think for people that are looking to jazz up a cocktail night at home, that maybe it would be good to get one that, you know, had a sort of a maybe salt. Would be nice if you wanted to have a margarita or something like that.
I've done a Hidden Valley Ranch Powder cocktail rim. I feel like there's a lot of opportunities if Honda wants to, you know, get me on the phone.
I think the last time I got sick from drinking was a friend who's now a restaurant chef, was really into just like messing around with like stoner food for a long time. And he had a party where he was serving what he called Dorita-ritas, which were margaritas made with just like stuff from the store. But the rim of the glass was crushed up Cool Ranch Doritos that he had gotten to adhere to it. Mm. And I drank it during the day on a hot day outside. And then I had 99 bananas, which is a banana liqueur that I think is primarily used as a disinfectant or as punishment, I guess, in certain contexts. And I not only was I mad because I got sick from drinking, this was like, you know, 15 years ago, but I was also like, everything that I drank was so obviously stupid that it was all clearly trending in that direction. That there was just no way that it could have gone that would have been good for me. And then it happened to be exactly as bad as it should have been. I guess I could have learned a lesson from that, but it took me like another 5 years to figure it out.
That's what I'm all about. I mean, I made Hidden Valley Ranch popsicles just to see what the experience would be.
Oh my God.
So, you know.
How was it?
Can you break down the visual on that? Because I'm not loving it in my mind's eye.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's in a newsletter. I did take a picture, so you can look it up after the fact. But it's a creamy, opaque, white popsicle. It looks exactly the way that you would expect. But then I did dress it up a little bit by, like, dipping it in the ranch powder, so you get kind of, like, that nice candied effect.
Mm. Yeah, that's nice is exactly the word that popped into my head when you described dipping a ranch dressing popsicle into ranch dressing powder.
I wonder if there's ranch flavored vodka. Like, I bet someone has, because my most famous, well, I shouldn't say famous, in my mind, the worst time I got sick from drinking was when I went to a Halloween party and there was an ice luge and they had smoked salmon flavored vodka. And I was like, this is delicious. It tastes just like smoked salmon, because I was really shit-faced. And then I got even more shit-faced. And then the next morning, I was like, thinking about it. Like, I thought about what I drank. And even today, I'm like,
smoked salmon-flavored vodka is like, I'm willing to humor it. Like, it might work, but I don't feel like at any volume it's going to do anything good for you.
Probably not. No.
Maybe freshen your breath.
Hey, let's take a quick break with Liz Cook and come back, and we'll play some games and open up the fun bag. We'll be right back.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Vacations are always good. Sometimes they're even great. And Celebrity Cruises is about to ruin all of that. Because once you explore with us, you'll never want a vacation any other way. And with new quick Caribbean escapes, you'll never want a weekend any other way either. Celebrity Cruises. Nothing comes close. Visit celebrity.com, call 1-800-CELEBRITY, or contact your travel advisor. Ships Registry, Malta and Ecuador.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
We're back. We're going to play some games with Liz Cook of The Pitch. Liz, would you like to remember a guy? Every week we remember a guy in sports. And I had one guy I was going to remember, but it was a baseball guy. And for you, we have a special Arsenal guy to remember this week. Would you like to remember a guy?
I would love to remember a guy.
How about Thierry Henry? Do you remember Thierry Henry?
Just the best guy to remember, honestly.
Does he still play for Arsenal?
He was a player for Arsenal. He is now.
He's now a fan.
He is now sitting in the stands and hopefully one day will coach us.
He was also a New York, New Jersey Red Bull, I believe, for a while.
I think that's right.
And I remember he really liked New York. That the one time I got to see him play in real life was Steve Nash used to have this like charity soccer game on the Lower East Side that was a really bizarre collection of like Mark Stein played in it, the NBA writer, but also the time that I saw it, it was just in Sarah D. Roosevelt Park, like, so not a glamorous Lower East Side park. And they were playing on an outdoor, like, AstroTurf soccer pitch. And it was Steve Nash, Chris Bosh, Baron Davis, and then also, like, Thierry Henry played in that. And there's another guy, Robbie something, who was, like, a big deal British player, white dude. And it was great fun to watch. Like, Henri was the single best, like, it's as close as I've ever been to an absolute master doing this stuff. And I remember him leaving and he was like sort of lightly mobbed. But then like after a few more steps, he was just an ordinary dude walking down like Stanton, which I think really appealed to him. Like he always talked about how much he liked New York. And I think some of it is that he wasn't getting yelled at the way that he might have when he lived in London.
Well, Thierry Henry is a perfect guy for this segment because we are already like remembering him and lionizing him as though he were long deceased. Like there is already a statue of him outside of Emirates Stadium, which
is there really?
Yeah, yeah.
I like it. I think every soccer luminary who comes over to MLS is very happy about it and says very nice things because the standard is so much lower. Like us American fans were like, oh my fucking God, like Thierry Henry's on
like, he
our
can
team.
With both feet. Yeah.
Yeah. Like when Wayne Rooney came to DC United, I was like, that's bitching. He was like 58 years old and had no hair. And I was like, oh, Wayne Rooney, man, that is fucking kick ass. And they get like, you know, they get some extra dough and everybody's nice to him. So it's like a perfect little, it's like a perfect little denouement for a career just to ease into retirement by making a little extra money and have Americans who know nothing to say really nice shit about you. It's great. Yeah.
I mean, that was the David Beckham route with the LA Galaxy, right?
It was 1,000%. He was the pioneer of the goddamn. Yeah.
I mean, he was going to move to LA anyway. You can't, like, eventually everybody that is that hot and also tattooed will live in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's cool that he was able to leverage a couple of years of physical activity out of it.
Hey, do you want to play Dead or Canceled, Liz Cook? You ready to play Dead or Canceled?
I would love to.
All right. So I'm going to give you the name of a person. You got to tell me whether they're dead or canceled. Can you do that?
Okay. Just any person?
Well, no, I'm going to give you the name of
Oh, you're going to give me the name. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, someone yeah, no. You don't.
Okay, good.
I'm not going to make you do the work. All right, is this person dead or canceled? Actor Walter Matthau. I can't believe I just botched Walter Matthau's name. Walter Matthau, is he dead or canceled?
I mean, he's got to be dead, right?
He is dead, okay. Yes, of course. Fabulous actor, wonderful actor, but yes, he is dead.
I'm glad he didn't live to be canceled, I guess I should say.
Yeah, because it could have happened. Yeah. Like, I feel like he was the guy that, you know, like, I bet if you got him going on horse racing and how it's changed, you'd get a lot of really spicy opinions.
Let's move on to the fun bag and open up the fun bag.
I got
Andy
more Matthau
writes
stuff.
In.
I got another 5 minutes on Matthau, Drew.
Oh, all right. You want to keep going?
No, I don't.
Just do the type five, David. It's fine.
I'm of the generation.
You Pelham 123 fans out there? I see my man laughing because he knows. That's
I'm of the generation where I recognize him most from like grumpy old men, which is really not how you ought to remember Walter Matthau, but that was one of the first like preeminent movies I saw him in. I'm like, oh, that's the guy from Grumpy Old Men. I'm sure his family would be like, he was in other movies too, Drew. Like that were like superior.
Academy Award winner.
Yeah.
Did more than Ice Fish with Jack Lemmon.
Well, there's like a generation of kids who will only remember Clint Eastwood for yelling at that chair. So I feel like it's always the timeline's always shifting.
That's 1,000% true. I was like, I'm still dying at the name of the movie Cry Macho. Like I'm sure the context of it fits with the movie, but it's called Cry Macho, and that's such a fucking stupid name for a movie starring a 91-year-old man.
I don't know anything about this movie, but I assume it's like trying to do a fun new take on like crying uncle when you're beating someone up and like trying to spin that into a macho setting.
Sort of. So the one thing I can tell you from the little bit that I've read about it is that Macho is a chicken. Macho is
yes.
a fighting rooster, and like... I guess also, you know, the movie is about machismo, but that adds a nice little element to me. As someone who does not plan on seeing the movie, I feel like knowing that it's directed by and starring a 91-year-old man who is rescuing a child and a fighting cock from Mexico, like, that's cool. Like, I feel like I like that movie as much knowing that as I would if I ever saw it.
Let's open up the fun bag. And this is from Bob. Bob writes in, the Blue Angels, the Navy flight squadron that tours the country performing air shows, and the neocon fluffboys of aviation, they're bullshit, right? A gross misuse of our tax dollars, costing our taxpayers a sweet $40 million a year, not to mention each plane costs around $50 million. I brought this up at a party and was promptly branded a jihadi by the rest of the NIMBY fucks I associate with, but I think there's more than just the reasons above to cancel this shit and put that money into just about anything else. Liz Cook, do you like the Blue Angels, or do you think they're bullshit?
Oh, man, this is like... of course, if you bring up at a party, like, you know, the really cool planes that make loud noises and go very fast are bad, actually, people are going to get mad at you. Like, this is not that hard to suss out. So I have to disagree, and I have to disclose here that I recently went up in an air show plane for a piece I wrote, so I have a little bit of skin in the game.
Wow, what type of plane was it?
It was a sky typer. It was like a World War I era plane that just like poots out smoke and types things. They actually got in a lot of trouble because they are also, so it's sponsored by Geico, this fleet of sky typers, and they got in some trouble because they were taking just sky typing for hire, you know, like proposals, things like that, spelling out stuff.
Sure.
And they took on a contract where they put up anti-Armenian genocide propaganda without realizing it.
Wait, does that mean they were for the recognition of the Armenian genocide?
Like denying it. Like they put up propaganda denying Armenian. The Armenian genocide. Yeah.
My wife is Armenian, so I'm very angry about that. Though.
Yes.
That's very bad.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever. Everything feels like a background detail in a lesser Don DeLillo novel now. Like, literally every story that I read. But that one especially, the idea of getting busted for pro-genocide skywriting and being like, hey, man, it's just a job. I just write what they give me.
Yeah, yeah. So I didn't bring this up with the person who was flying me because I didn't, you know, want to get tossed out of the plane. But his name, his call sign was Gooch, which I also thought was incredible.
Yeah, this is making me reconsider a lot of things.
How was the flight? Did it make you ill?
No, it was amazing. I mean, it wasn't a Blue Angel flight. I mean, this is like a World War I aircraft, so it's not going anywhere near that fast.
But there's no barrel rolls involved?
There's no barrel rolls, but they did some maneuvers, and like you can just pull the canopy back, and you're just out there exposed to the wind, baby. Like, there's no roof. It was a ton of fun, and I also was there like watching the air show while the Blue Angels took off, and like, yes, I understand all of the arguments, terrible for climate change, but like there's so much, like this is so far down the list of things we need to fix, I think, that I can't be that arsed.
Yeah, I kind of expected it to be more expensive. Like I thought that especially given how much money we spend on like fighter jets that can only crash, like that's the only function that they know how to do properly. Like it's surprising that, you know, like $40 or $50 million, like the Mets are going to spend more than that this offseason on a guy who's going to make 10 starts and then get hurt.
So, and they get
like,
arrested.
It honestly seems like a pretty good deal. If you can get like a fighter jet and a Gooch to fly it, that's pretty tight.
I'm torn here because my grandma took me to a Blue Angel show when I was like 7 or something. She really sold it. I was like, oh, I'm going to see the Jets and all that stuff. And they're so fucking loud. My ears hurt. I was like crying. I was very upset. And I didn't like the planes at all. And I asked to be taken away from the show. So I hated the Blue Angels like for the bulk of my childhood until Van Halen released the Dreams video. That's nothing
not
but footage of the Blue Angels flying. And it's a fantastic video.
Yeah.
And a truly inspiring song. And so I'm torn here. If without the Blue Angels, we would not have had the Dreams video. And that's what, $56 million? I mean, it's 10 planes in it, so $560 million, but for a most triumphant video. And so I don't know how I feel about it.
If you had given me an infinite amount of time to guess how Drew was going to finish the sentence that included, I was opposed to the Blue Angels until it never would have. The idea that Van Hagar could figure into that response would never have occurred to me. My hat is off to you, sir.
I definitely like would sing along to Dreams like in the car and like get to the end. Like when he sings, "That's what love is made of." Like I would feel that. Like I would get a little misty. Hey, Matt writes in. This is a good question for you, Liz Cook. My coworkers and I are discussing sports movies, and the topic of good soccer movies came up, as in, are there any? I remember Ladybugs with Rodney Dangerfield and Mean Machine with Vinnie Jones, but those are both somewhere between campy and straight up bad. One coworker said there are probably some good soccer films in Spanish language cinema, so now the debate is if those movies would translate to English well. We still think that Nike commercial Guy Ritchie made is the best option on the table. Your verdict, Liz Cook, are there any good soccer movies?
Man, I don't know if I'm the right person for this question because I'm trying to think of like good soccer movies. And the only one that's coming to mind is Bend It Like Beckham, which I don't
Same for me.
Oh, I thought that was
really a soccer movie.
Yeah,
that's more of a like getting kissed movie.
No,
you can do both.
It's a soccer. I mean, the best sports movies are the ones where, you know, like you can say Raging Bull is not a boxing movie and it's a character study and be correct. Like it's like, the sports part, it doesn't have to end with the big game, right? It can still be a sports movie and not end that way.
I mean, we're like 2 years from a Ted Lasso movie, right?
Oh, boy.
If that. if that. Although everyone's mad at Ted Lasso
that one
now.
Pretty fast though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't. Do you watch it, Liz?
I saw the first season. I haven't watched any of the second.
Was the first season good?
It's really sweet. It's something you can kind of turn your brain off and enjoy.
What everyone that I know has said about the first season, that they all really appreciated it contextually when they were watching it because it was like a super dark time, and that it was just like a nice hang, like just like a warm televisual experience. I don't know anybody that's like going to go back and revisit it, and it does seem like you made the right choice in terms of when you bailed on it.
It's been very weird because I haven't seen Ted Lasso, but just to watch the discourse on it evolve, because like at the beginning people were like, oh, well, you know, it's based off an ad. It's not going to be good. And then everyone was like, oh, my God, it's amazing. And then now people are like, there's people who are like, oh, my God, it fucking sucks. And then people who talk about it, like, if you didn't know it was a show, you would think they were talking about a fucking seminar or something like that. Like, I don't know what the hell's going on with people who like stan it.
So this is something I'm actually very worried about as someone who also still works in the corporate world, is that like much of the first season, at least, was about like being a coach and being a manager and like inspiring people by being kind. And I know that I'm like 2 months away from having to sit through like a corporate leadership seminar that's like managing the Lasso way.
Oh, yeah. That's for sure. That's like the real, like we're way likelier to get, you know, management tips of the imaginary mustachioed Jason Sudeikis guy than we are to get like a feature film of it. But yeah, there will certainly be some sort of, you know, The Lasso Way, like a book with raised text that you can get only in airports. That'll happen for sure.
So I think we come around. I think the answer is Bend It by like Beckham, because it's really kind of the only soccer movie we know that isn't Ladybugs, Mean Machine, or like Victory from like 1980.
Well, there's one other one that I know of but have not seen called The Damned United, which is adapted from a book by It's adapted from a book by a writer that I really admire named David Peace, who wrote the Red Riding series of books and stuff, and he is fucking weird. Like the books are really good but really jarring to read, like kind of not under punctuated but like it's idiosyncratically punctuated, like really sort of a dark and strange view of the world. Tokyo Year Zero is one I really liked. And he wrote a 600-page book about Manchester United in that style called The Damned United. And I don't know like what that would be like. I don't care enough about soccer probably to read it. But the idea of like one of my favorite strangest novelists writing a sprawling book about like the Milwaukee Bucks is very appealing to me. And if it were about any other sport, I probably would have read it at this point.
The other thing is that Nick Hornby's famous novel, Fever Pitch, was adapted into a movie starring Colin Firth, but it was never released here. I remember it was released in England because I was abroad in England in 1997 when it came out. It was only released here as a remake starring, of course, Jimmy Fallon and Drew Barrymore, and they were rooting for the fucking Red Sox, and that was the movie. But the original Fever Pitch movie was true to its source material and was about soccer. So for all I know, it's a good movie, but we were just never allowed to see it here in America. So, Andy writes in, Liz. He says, I hate my name. It sucks. Andy. Yes, technically it's Andrew, which is fine, but I'm 42 and I can't tell people, oh, I go by Andrew now without sounding like a complete prick. I've gone by Andy since I was a kid. All my friends will tell me to fuck off if I tell them to call me Drew or Andrew. Plus, when I was younger, my mom said when I was almost either Zachary or Nathan, if you could, would you change your name and what would you change it to? I actually wrote back personally to Andy and said, just go by, tell people to call you Drew or Andrew. And even if they give you shit for it, you'll come out the other side and they'll respect you if they love you. So that's what I said to him. But have you ever had this problem, Liz, with people you know or with yourself not liking your name many, many years into your life?
Well, I don't have direct experience for that, but I have thought about this a lot from a similar realm, because Elizabeth is ripe for nicknames. And I just like settled on one because it was really short and easy to write as a child. And I feel like I missed out on all of these opportunities. Like, you know, people go with Betsy, they go with Betty, but like there's some weirder options. There's Zabeth, Zabby. I want to be a Zabby.
Really? There's Zabby?
No, I'm just saying like we could invent that. Like there's opportunities.
I thought you were saying like there was someone in Utah who did that, and I was like,
there probably is.
Oh, there certainly is. Yeah, like the lady with the dry erase board that has like Michaela and Navy written on it. Yes, that person is definitely experimenting with Zabby as we speak.
I mean, I
By the way,
go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, I want to tell Andy the same thing, but like, yeah, go ahead. Just tell people to call you Drew. But I do think that that's going to be a tough sell on the friend group. I think it's easier to pick something that's like completely divorced from your name. Like, it'll be easier to get your friend group to call you Chugs than, you know, like Drew.
I really am very taken by the idea of breaking out a syllabic portion of a name that you like more than the whole thing and just going from Andrew to Andre, like just because you feel like sassing it up and getting, you know, sort of a personal rebrand.
Yeah.
That was my name in Spanish.
Should do that.
That was my name in Spanish class when I was a kid. So I was like, oh, I get to be Andres for 40 entire minutes until the bell.
Yeah. I mean, David, how do you feel about like Vidi? I mean, I feel like we could go in some different directions here.
I think Vidi would be extremely tight. Like Avi is kind of, that's promising a level of Israeliness that I thankfully cannot deliver. But I think that there is, yeah, there, my name doesn't have as much. I wish it was a little bit longer in that way. The one thing that's weird for me is that like, because David Lee Roth was really famous for the first, I don't know, 20 years of my life, that the David J. Roth thing, which people like professionally will call me that, like that's only my Twitter handle. It's only like an initial I've ever used because I need to draw a distinction between myself and the Panama guy. And I don't think that that's necessary anymore. Because like I got big, but just because he lives in like a weird house in Pasadena now and like nobody really worries about him as much.
I thought it was like Screen Actors Guild rules. Like you had to choose this and stick with it forever.
That may very well be. Yeah. This was my very limited screen acting experience hasn't really forced that on me. It would be cool. I mean, I feel like if I live in New York for another 10 years, now that they're bringing back Law and Order, I will appear in an episode somehow. But I think that I should be able to get by with the J, I guess, in that regard.
By the way, if you want weird cultural arcana that only I think about, I remember in Working Girl, Harrison Ford was going to dance with the like daughter of like a big CEO, and her name was Elizabeth, but he had to fake like he knew her, and so he's like asking around like, does she go by Beth or Betsy or Liz, and like one of the old ladies goes Bitsy, and he's like Bitsy, okay, all right, and then he has to go up and go Bitsy, tell me you don't remit. Tell me you don't remember me. And she like plays along. But ever since then, whenever I think of nicknames for Elizabeth, I think of Bitsy first because of that fucking scene. And I haven't seen Working Girl in like 30 years. So there you go. That's my incredible story, Liz.
That's pretty good, though. If you were going to tell a story about the name Bitsy, that you really tied it in. Like it makes sense. Beginning, middle, and end.
Do you want to do one more?
Let's do it.
Yeah, I think we should.
All right. Roth, this is from John. I'm going to have you answer this one, Roth, yourself, and then we'll move on to one that Liz can answer, too. John writes in, how does the New York subway still work during a flood? Why isn't anybody getting electrocuted from the water hitting the third rail? They put mouse tape on the third rail.
So I asked this question in Slack, and everybody was like, because it's insulated, don't worry about it. And I felt so stupid. I mean, like, stupid in a way that I haven't felt since middle school, because part of me, like, they were like, well, you know, power lines don't short out when it rains. And I literally was just like, all right, I'm gonna leave now. I have to go do something else. And just because I didn't have any answer for that. I was also confused by the question, but I think the answer is the miracle of insulating electrical current.
Will writes in, Liz Cook, at what point can you start using undefeated when referring to a team? For example, is it acceptable to call Notre Dame undefeated right now when they're only 3-0 with wins over bad teams? It's technically true, but it just rubs me the wrong way. As a soccer fan, Liz Cook, how many wins do you get in before you think undefeated can really be used?
Oh, I mean, I don't think any wins are even necessary. Like, I think you can use undefeated before the season has begun and wave that banner strong and wrong. You know, like what? Like life is a struggle. We're all just trying to like grasp whatever scraps of optimism and happiness we can from this wretched earth. I think, like, why not undefeated? I like it.
Wow. Yeah, like the idea of lasso more luck.
Yeah, but like rolling that out there for a team that's got like 2 wins, no losses, and like 9 ties. I would latch on to undefeated there as well. I'd just be like, yeah, well, you know, like beat us if you don't think we're good.
That's like the year when I was a teenager when Michigan went 8-0-3 and like finished like 10th in the rankings, but they were undefeated.
Three ties?
They had three fucking ties under Gary Mueller. It was the goddamnest thing.
I mean, it's sort of like I'm an undefeated UFC fighter.
Yeah. It's true. You are.
I guess we all are.
That is 1,000% true. I'm going to read one more just to sign us off. It's from Joe. And Joe writes in, I went to a concert this past weekend for the first time in 2 years. Outdoor venues, small crowds, vaccine checking at the entry, and I wore my gross gas shirt. Three separate people that night came up and asked me, is that you, about my shirt? I don't have a question. I just wanted to say that it is an honor to be mistaken for David Roth and to apologize to David Roth for being mistaken for me. Let's see, you know, we sell a shirt that depicts David standing next to a tank that says gross gas, and he gives the thumbs up. And this person looked like David Roth. So that's such a nice thing.
I think a lot of people kind of look like the defector birthday party was full of a lot of people that look kind of like me.
I absolutely, I mistook like five people for you at that.
So I replied to that, which is just a sense of how powerful my brand has become. I replied to that email and I appreciated his kind words, but also made the point that it's absolutely his fault. And anybody who wears that shirt, whatever happens to you while you're wearing it, that's on you, man.
Liz Cook, you've been a fantastic guest. Will you come on again sometime?
I would love to.
Oh, brilliant. Because Liz Cook, you can find her at Liz Cook KC on Twitter. And her Haterade newsletter, which I subscribe to, is fantastic. She's also a freelance food critic for The Pitch, so read her there as well. Brandon Nix is our producer and engineer. Daisy Rosario is our executive producer. Our theme song is by Kirk Hamilton. You can listen to ad-free episodes of The Distraction only on Stitcher Premium. And thanks to Roth and me and Liz Cook this week, you can get a free month of Stitcher Premium right now. Just go to StitcherPremium.com and use the promo code DISTRACT. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe wherever it is that you listen. And go subscribe to Defector.com, too, while you're at it. Next week, Roth, we have to pimp the book. The book's coming out on October 12th.
Book? Did I write one?
No, you didn't write one. You're not.
Oh, is it your book, The Night the Lights Went Out?
You lack the fortitude. The Night the Lights Went Out comes out October 12th. And we have to figure out a way to celebrate that next week by talking about me all the time. But this week, it was a much greater pleasure to talk to Liz Cook. Thank you so much for coming on,
yeah,
Liz.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, stay swell.
We'll see you guys next week. Bye.
Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.